content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. With the recent release of the movie Oppenheimer, coinciding with the 78th anniversary of the nuclear attack on Japan by the U.S. on August 6, 1945, for the next 3 weeks, I will read Hiroshima by John Hersey, a first-hand account of the human impact on citizens of Hiroshima, published as the entire August 31, 1946 edition of the New Yorker magazine. Hersey was dispatched by the New Yorker to Hiroshima in May of 1946 to write an article describing the human impacts of the bomb. In plain, spare prose, Hersey documented scenes of unprecedented ruin and human suffering, capturing the ghostly residuum of calamity. Hersey organized his article around six survivors he interviewed in Hiroshima, ordinary Japanese with families, friends, and jobs just like Americans. Hersey writes that 100,000 people were killed by the atomic bomb, and these six were among the survivors, leaving them to still wonder why they lived when so many others died, or too busy or too weary or too badly hurt to care that they were the objects of the first great experiment in the use of atomic power, which no country except the United States, with its industrial know-how, its willingness to throw $2 billion gold dollars into an important wartime gamble, could possibly have developed. The August 31st, 1946 Hiroshima edition of the New Yorker sold out almost immediately on newsstands, with Albert Einstein even attempting to buy 1,000 copies. Later, serialized in newspapers across the country, Hersey's Hiroshima became the first human account of the attack for most Americans. To this day, it remains one of the most important works of journalism ever created. Today, I will read the third part of Hiroshima by John Hersey. If you missed the first two parts, you can find them at our website, ncreadingservice.org, under the podcast section, New Yorker Magazine. And so, with no further ado, the third part of Hiroshima by John Hersey. In the park, Mrs. Murata kept Father Kleinsorge awake all night by talking to him. None of the Nakamura family were able to sleep either. The children, in spite of being very sick, were interested in everything that happened. They were delighted when one of the city's gas storage tanks went up in a tremendous burst of flame. Toshio, the boy, shouted to the others to look at the reflection in the river. Mr. Tanimoto, after his long run and his many hours of rescue work, dozed uneasily. When he awoke, in the first light of dawn, he looked across the river and saw that he had not carried the festered, limp bodies high enough on the sandspit the night before. The tide had risen above where he had put them. They had not had the strength to move. They must have drowned. He saw a number of bodies floating in the river. Early that day, August 7th, the Japanese radio broadcast for the first time a succinct announcement that very few, if any, of the people most concerned with its content, the survivors in Hiroshima, happened to hear. Quote, Hiroshima suffered considerable damage as a result of an attack by a few B-29s. It is believed that a new type of bomb was used. The details are being investigated. End quote. Nor is it probable that any of the survivors happened to be tuned in on a shortwave rebroadcast of an extraordinary announcement by the President of the United States, which identified the new bomb as atomic. Quote, that bomb had more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It had more than 2,000 times the blast power of the British Grand Slam, which is the largest bomb ever used in the history of warfare. End quote. Those victims who were able to worry at all about what had happened, thought of it and discussed it in more primitive, childish terms. Gasoline sprinkled from an airplane, maybe, or some combustible gas, or a big cluster of incendiaries, or the work of parachutists. But even if they had known the truth, most of them were too busy, or too weary, or too badly hurt to care that they were the objects of the first great experiment in the use of atomic power, which, as the voices on the shortwave shouted, no country except the United States, with its industrial know-how, its willingness to throw $2 billion gold dollars into an important wartime gamble, could possibly have developed. Mr. Tanimoto was still angry at doctors. He decided that he would personally bring one to Asano Park by the scruff of the neck if necessary. He crossed the river, went past the Shinto shrine where he had met his wife for a brief moment the day before, and walked to the East Parade Ground. Since this had long before been designated as an evacuation area, he thought he would find an aid station there. He did find one, operated by an Army medical unit, but he also saw that its doctors were hopelessly overburdened, with thousands of patients sprawled among corpses across the field in front of it. Nevertheless, he went up to one of the Army doctors and said, as reproachfully as he could, "Why have you not come to Asano Park? You are badly needed there." Without even looking up from his work, the doctor said in a tired voice, "This is my station. But there are many dying on the riverbank over there." "The first duty," the doctor said, "is to take care of the slightly wounded." "Why, when there are many, many who are heavily wounded on the riverbank?" The doctor moved to another patient. "In an emergency like this," he said, as if he were reciting from a manual, "the first task is to help as many as possible, to save as many lives as possible. There is no hope for the heavily wounded. They will die. We can't bother with them." "Might be right from a medical standpoint," Mr. Tanimoto began, but then he looked out across the field, where the many dead lay close and intimate with those who were still living, and he turned away without finishing his sentence, angry now with himself. He didn't know what to do. He had promised some of the dying people in the park that he would bring them medical aid. They might die feeling cheated. He saw a ration stand at one side of the field, and he went to it and begged some rice cakes and biscuits. And he took them back, in lieu of doctors, to the people in the park. The morning, again, was hot. Father Kleinsorge went to fetch water for the wounded in a bottle and a teapot he had borrowed. He had heard that it was possible to get fresh tap water outside Asano Park. Going through the rock gardens, he had to climb over and crawl under the trunks of fallen pine trees. He found he was weak. There were many dead in the gardens. At a beautiful moon bridge, he passed a naked, living woman who seemed to have been burned from head to toe and was red all over. Near the entrance to the park, an army doctor was working, but the only medicine he had was iodine, which he painted over cuts, bruises, slimy burns, everything. And by now, everything that he painted had pus on it. Outside the gate of the park, Father Kleinsorge found a faucet that still worked, part of the plumbing of a vanished house, and he filled his vessels and returned. When he had given the wounded the water, he made a second trip. This time, the woman by the bridge was dead. On his way back with the water, he got lost on a detour around a fallen tree, and as he looked for his way through the woods, he heard a voice ask from the underbrush, "Have you anything to drink?" He saw a uniform. Thinking there was just one soldier, he approached with the water. When he had penetrated the bushes, he saw there were about 20 men, and they were all in exactly the same nightmarish state. Their faces were wholly burned, their eye sockets were hollow, the fluid from their melted eyes had run down their cheeks. They must have had their faces upturned when the bomb went off. Perhaps they were anti-aircraft personnel. Their mouths were mere swollen, pus-covered wounds, which they could not bear to stretch enough to admit the spout of the teapot. So Father Kleinsorge got a large piece of grass and drew out the stem so as to make a straw, and gave them all water to drink that way. One of them said, "I can't see anything." Father Kleinsorge answered as cheerfully as he could, "There's a doctor at the entrance to the park. He's busy now, but he'll come soon and fix your eyes, I hope." Since that day, Father Kleinsorge has thought back to how queasy he had once been at the sight of pain, how someone else's cut finger used to make him turn faint. Yet, there in the park, he was so benumbed that immediately after leaving this horrible sight, he stopped on a path by one of the pools and discussed with a lightly wounded man whether it would be safe to eat the fat 2-foot carp that floated dead on the surface of the water. They decided, after some consideration, that it would be unwise. Father Kleinsorge filled the containers a third time and went back to the riverbank. There, amid the dead and the dying, he saw a young woman with a needle and thread mending her kimono, which had been slightly torn. Father Kleinsorge joshed her. "My, but you're a dandy," he said, and she laughed. He felt tired and lay down. He began to talk with two engaging children whose acquaintance he had made the afternoon before. He learned that their name was Kataoka. The girl was 13, the boy 5. The girl had been just about to set out for a barber shop when the bomb fell. As the family started for Asano Park, their mother decided to turn back for some food and extra clothing. They became separated from her in the crowd of fleeing people, and they had not seen her since. Occasionally, they stopped suddenly in their perfectly cheerful playing and began to cry for their mother. It was difficult for all the children in the park to sustain the sense of tragedy. Toshio Nakamura got quite excited when he saw his friend Saichi Sato riding up the river in a boat with his family, and he ran to the bank and waved and shouted, "Sato! Sato!" The boy turned his head and shouted, "Who's that?" "Nakamura! Hello, Toshio! Are you all safe?" "Yes, but what about you?" "Yes, we're all right. My sisters are vomiting, but I'm fine." Father Kleinsorge began to be thirsty in the dreadful heat, and he did not feel strong enough to go for water again. A little before noon, he saw a Japanese woman handing something out. Soon she came to him and said in a kindly voice, "These are tea leaves. Chew them, young man, and you won't feel thirsty." The woman's gentleness made Father Kleinsorge suddenly want to cry. For weeks he had been feeling oppressed by the hatred of foreigners that the Japanese seemed increasingly to show, and he had been uneasy even with his Japanese friends. This stranger's gesture made him a little hysterical. Around noon, the priest arrived from the novitiate with the handcart. They had been to the site of the mission house in the city and had retrieved some suitcases that had been stored in the air raid shelter, and had also picked up the remains of melted holy vessels in the ashes of the chapel. They now packed Father Kleinsorge's papier-mâché suitcase and the things belonging to Mrs. Murata and the Nakamuras into the cart, put the two Nakamura girls aboard, and prepared to start out. Then one of the Jesuits, who had a practical turn of mind, remembered that they had been notified some time before that if they suffered property damage at the hands of the enemy, they could enter a claim for compensation with the prefectural police. The holy men discussed this matter there in the park, with the wounded as silent as the dead around them, and decided that Father Kleinsorge, as a former resident of the destroyed mission, was the one to enter the claim. So, as the others went off with the handcart, Father Kleinsorge said goodbye to the Kataoka children and trudged to a police station. Fresh, clean uniformed policemen from another town were in charge, and a crowd of dirty and disarrayed citizens crowded around them, mostly asking after lost relatives. Father Kleinsorge filled out a claim form and started walking through the center of town on his way to Nagatsuka. It was then that he first realized the extent of the damage. He passed block after block of ruins, and even after all he had seen in the park, his breath was taken away. By the time he reached the novitiate, he was sick with exhaustion. The last thing he did as he fell into bed was request that someone go back for the motherless Kataoka children. Altogether, Miss Sasaki was left 2 days and two nights under the piece of propped-up roofing with her crushed leg and her two unpleasant comrades. Her only diversion was when men came to the factory air raid shelters, which she could see from under one corner of her shelter, and hauled corpses up out of them with ropes. Her leg became discolored, swollen, and putrid. All that time she went without food and water. On the third day, August 8th, some friends who supposed she was dead came to look for her body and found her. They told her that her mother, father, and baby brother, who at the time of the explosion were in the Tamura Pediatric Hospital, where the baby was a patient, had all been given up as certainly dead, since the hospital was totally destroyed. Her friends then left her to think that piece of news over. Later, some men picked her up by the arms and legs and carried her quite a distance to a truck. For about an hour, the truck moved over a bumpy road, and Miss Sasaki, who had become convinced that she was dulled to pain, discovered that she was not. The men lifted her out at a relief station in the section of Inokuchi, where two army doctors looked at her. The moment one of them touched her wound, she fainted. She came to in time to hear them discuss whether or not to cut off her leg. One said that there was gas gangrene in the lips of the wound and predicted she would die unless they amputated. And the other said that was too bad because they had no equipment with which to do the job. She fainted again. When she recovered consciousness, she was being carried somewhere on a stretcher. She was put aboard a launch, which went to the nearby island of Ninoshima, and she was taken to a military hospital there. Another doctor examined her and said that she did not have gas gangrene, though she did have a fairly ugly compound fracture. He said quite coldly that he was sorry, but this was a hospital for operative surgical cases only, and because she had no gangrene, she would have to return to Hiroshima that night. But then the doctor took her temperature, and what he saw on the thermometer made him decide to let her stay. That day, August 8th, Father Sieslik went into the city to look for Mr. Fukai, the Japanese secretary of the diocese, who had ridden unwillingly out of the flaming city on Father Kleinsorge's back and had then had run back crazily into it. Father Sieslik started hunting in the neighborhood of Sakai Bridge, where the Jesuits had last seen Mr. Fukai. He went to the East Parade Ground, the evacuation area to which the secretary might have gone, and looked for him among the wounded and dead there. He went to the prefectural police and made inquiries. He could not find any trace of the man. Back at the novitiate that evening, the theological student who had been rooming with Mr. Fukai at the mission house told the priest that the secretary had remarked to him during an air raid alarm one day, not long before the bombing, "Japan is dying. If there is a real air raid here in Hiroshima, I want to die with our country." The priest concluded that Mr. Fukai had run back to immolate himself in the flames. They never saw him again. At the Red Cross Hospital, Dr. Sasaki worked for 3 straight days with only 1 hour's sleep. On the second day, he began to sew up the worst cuts, and right through the following night and all the next day, he stitched. Many of the wounds were festered. Fortunately, someone had found intact a supply of narukopin, a Japanese sedative, and he gave it to many who were in pain. Word went around among the staff that there must have been something peculiar about that great bomb, because on the second day, the vice chief of the hospital went down in the basement to the vault where the X-ray plates were stored and found the whole stock exposed as they lay. That day, a fresh doctor and 10 nurses came in from the city of Yamaguchi with extra bandages and antiseptics. And the third day, another physician and 12 more nurses arrived from Matsui. Yet, there were still only 8 doctors for 10,000 patients. In the afternoon of the third day, exhausted from his foul tailoring, Dr. Sasaki became obsessed with the idea that his mother thought he was dead. He got permission to go to Mukaihara. He walked out to the first suburbs, beyond which the electric train service was still functioning, and reached home late in the evening. His mother said she had known he was all right all along. A wounded nurse had stopped by to tell her. He went to bed and slept for 17 hours. Before dawn on August 8th, someone entered the room at the novitiate where Father Kleinsorger was in bed, reached up to the hanging light bulb, and switched it on. The sudden flood of light pouring in on Father Kleinsorger's half-sleep brought him leaping out of bed, braced for a new concussion. When he realized what had happened, he laughed confusedly and went back to bed. He stayed there all day. On August 9th, Father Kleinsorger was still tired. The rector looked at his cuts and said they were not even worth dressing, and if Father Kleinsorger kept them clean, they would heal in 3 or 4 days. Father Kleinsorger felt uneasy. He could not yet comprehend what he had been through. As if he were guilty of something awful, he felt he had to go back to the scene of the violence he had experienced. He got up out of bed and walked into the city. He scratched for a while in the ruins of the mission house, but he found nothing. He went to the sites of a couple of schools and asked after people he knew. He looked for some of the city's Japanese Catholics, but he found only fallen houses. He walked back to the novitiate, stupefied and without any new understanding. At 11:02 on the morning of August 9th, the second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. It was several days before the survivors of Hiroshima knew they had company, because the Japanese radio and newspapers were being extremely cautious on the subject of the strange weapon. On August 9th, Mr. Tanimoto was still working in the park. He went to the suburb of Ushida, where his wife was staying with friends, and got a tent which he had stored there before the bombing. He now took it to the park and set it up as a shelter for some of the wounded who could not move or be moved. Whatever he did in the park, he felt he was being watched by the 20-year-old girl, Mrs. Kamai, his former neighbor, whom he had seen on the day the bomb exploded, with her dead baby daughter in her arms. She kept the small corpse in her arms for 4 days, even though it began smelling bad on the second day. Once, Mr. Tanimoto sat with her for a while, and she told him that the bomb had buried her under their house with the baby strapped to her back, and that when she had dug herself free, she had discovered that the baby was choking, its mouth full of dirt. With her little finger, she had carefully cleaned out the infant's mouth, and for a time, the child had breathed normally and seemed all right. Then suddenly it had died. Mrs. Kamai also talked about what a fine man her husband was, and again urged Mr. Tanimoto to search for him. Since Mr. Tanimoto had been all through the city the first day and had seen terribly burned soldiers from Kamai's post, the Chugoku Regional Army Headquarters, everywhere, he knew it would be impossible to find Kamai, even if he were living. But of course he didn't tell her that. Every time she saw Mr. Tanimoto, she asked whether he had found her husband. Once, he tried to suggest that perhaps it was time to cremate the body, but Mrs. Kamai only held it tighter. He began to keep away from her, but whenever he looked at her, she was staring at him, and her eyes asked the same question. He tried to escape her glance by keeping his back turned to her as much as possible. The Jesuits took about 50 refugees into the exquisite chapel of the novitiate. The rector gave them what medical care he could, mostly just cleaning away of pus. Each of the Nakamuras was provided with a blanket and a mosquito net. Mrs. Nakamura and her younger daughter had no appetite and ate nothing. Her son and other daughter ate and lost each meal they were offered. On August 10th, a friend, Mrs. Osaki, came to see them and told them that her son, Hideo, had been burned alive in the factory where he worked. This Hideo had been a kind of hero to Toshio, who had often gone to the plant to watch him run his machine. that night. Toshio woke up screaming. He had dreamed that he had seen Mrs. Osaki coming out of an opening in the ground with her family, and then he saw Hideo at his machine, a big one with a revolving belt, and he himself was standing beside Hideo. And for some reason, this was terrifying. On August 10th, Father Kleinsorge, having heard from someone that Dr. Fujii had been injured and that he had eventually gone to the summer house of a friend of his named Okuma in the village of Fukawa, asked Father Sislik if he would go and see how Dr. Fujii was. Father Sislik went to Misasa Station outside Hiroshima, rode for 20 minutes on an electric train, and then walked for an hour and a half in a terribly hot sun to Mr. Okuma's house, which was beside the Ota River at the foot of a mountain. He found Dr. Fujii sitting in a chair in a kimono, applying compresses to his broken collarbone. The doctor told Father Sislik about having lost his glasses and said that his eyes bothered him. He showed the priest huge blue and green stripes where beams had bruised him. He offered the Jesuit first a cigarette and then whiskey, though it was only 11 in the morning. Father Sislik thought it would please Dr. Fujii if he took a little, so he said yes. A servant brought some Suntory whiskey, and the Jesuit, the doctor, and the host had a very pleasant chat. Mr. Okuma had lived in Hawaii, and he told some things about Americans. Dr. Fujii talked a bit about the disaster. He said that Mr. Okuma and a nurse had gone into the ruins of his hospital and brought back a small safe, which he had moved into his air raid shelter. This contained some surgical instruments, and Dr. Fujii gave Father Sislik a few pairs of scissors and tweezers for the rector at the novitiate. Father Sislik was bursting with some inside dope he had, but he waited until the conversation turned naturally to the mystery of the bomb. Then he said he knew what kind of bomb it was. He had the secret on the best authority, that of a Japanese newspaper man who had dropped in at the novitiate. The bomb was not a bomb at all. It was a kind of fine magnesium powder sprayed over the whole city by a single plane, and it exploded when it came into contact with the live wires of the city power system. That means, said Dr. Fujii, perfectly satisfied, since after all the information came from a newspaperman, that it can only be dropped on big cities and only in the daytime when tram lines and so forth are in operation. After 5 days of ministering to the wounded in the park, Mr. Tanimoto returned on August 11th to his parsonage and dug around in the ruins. He retrieved some diaries and church records that had been kept in books and were only charred around the edges, as well as some cooking utensils and pottery. While he was at work, a Miss Tanaka came and said that her father had been asking for him. Mr. Tanimoto had reason to hate her father, the retired shipping company official who, though he made a great show of his charity, was notoriously selfish and cruel, and who, just a few days before the bombing, had said openly to several people that Mr. Tanimoto was a spy for the Americans. Several times he had derided Christianity and called it un-Japanese. At the moment of the bombing, Mr. Tanaka had been walking in the street in front of the city's radio station. He received serious flash burns, but he was able to walk home. He took refuge in his neighborhood association shelter, and from there tried hard to get medical aid. He expected all the doctors of Hiroshima to come to him, because he was so rich and so famous for giving his money away. When none of them came, he angrily set out to look for them. Leaning on his daughter's arm, he walked from private hospital to private hospital. But all were in ruins. And he went back and lay down in the shelter again. Now he was very weak and knew he was going to die. He was willing to be comforted by any religion. Mr. Tanimoto went to help him. He descended into the tomb-like shelter, and when his eyes were adjusted to the darkness, saw Mr. Tanaka, his face and arms puffed up and covered with pus and blood, and his eyes swollen shut. The old man smelled very bad, and he moaned constantly. He seemed to recognize Mr. Tanimoto's voice. Standing at the shelter stairway to get light, Mr. Tanimoto read loudly from a Japanese-language pocket Bible. "For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday, when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Thou carriest the children of men away as with a flood. They are as asleep. In the morning they are like grass which groweth up. In the morning it flourisheth and groweth up. In the evening it is cut down and withereth. For we are consumed by thine anger, and by thy wrath are we troubled. Thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. For all our days are passed away in thy wrath. We spend our years as a tale that is told." Mr. Tanaka died as Mr. Tanimoto read the psalm. On August 11th, word came to Ninoshima Military Hospital that a large number of military casualties from the Chugoku Regional Army Headquarters were to arrive on the island that day, and it was deemed necessary to evacuate all civilian patients. Miss Sasaki, still running an alarmingly high fever, was put on a large ship. She lay out on a deck, with a pillow under her leg. There were awnings over the deck, but the vessel's course put her in the sunlight. She felt as if she were under a magnifying glass in the sun. Pus oozed out of her wound, and soon the whole pillow was covered with it. She was taken ashore at Hatsukaichi, a town several miles to the southwest of Hiroshima, and put in the Goddess of Mercy Primary School, which had been turned into a hospital. She lay there for several days before a specialist on fractures came from Kobe. By then, her leg was red and swollen up to her hip. The doctor decided he could not set the brakes. He made an incision and put in a rubber pipe to drain off the putrescence. At the novitiate, the motherless Kataoka children were inconsolable. Father Sislik worked hard to keep them distracted. He put riddles to them. He asked, "What is the cleverest animal in the world?" And after the 13-year-old girl had guessed the ape, the elephant, the horse, he said, "No, it must be hippopotamus. Because in Japanese, that animal is kaba, the reverse of baka, stupid." He told Bible stories, beginning in the order of things, with the creation. He showed them a scrapbook of snapshots taken in Europe. Nevertheless, they cried most of the time for their mother. Several days later, Father Sislik started hunting for the children's family. First, he learned through the police that an uncle had been to the authorities in Kure, a city not far away, to inquire for the children. After that, he heard that an older brother had been trying to trace them through the post office in Ujina, a suburb of Hiroshima. Still later, he heard that the mother was alive and was on Goto Island off Nagasaki. And at last, by keeping a check on the Ujina post office, he got in touch with the brother and returned the children to their mother. About a week after the bomb dropped, a vague, incomprehensible rumor reached Hiroshima that the city had been destroyed by the energy released when atoms were somehow split in two. The weapon was referred to in this word-of-mouth report as Ginshi Bakudan, the root characters of which can be translated as original child bomb. No one understood the idea or put any more credence in it than in the powdered magnesium and such things. Newspapers were being brought in from other cities, but they were still confining themselves to extremely general statements, such as Domai's assertion on August 12th, quote, "There's nothing to do but admit the tremendous power of this inhuman bomb," end quote. Already, Japanese physicists had entered the city with Lauritsen electroscopes and Neher electrometers. They understood the idea all too well. On August 12th, the Nakamuras, all of them still rather sick, went to the nearby town of Kabe and moved in with Mrs. Nakamura's sister-in-law. The next day, Mrs. Nakamura, although she was too ill to walk much, returned to Hiroshima alone, by electric car to the outskirts, by foot from there. All week at the novitiate, she had worried about her mother, brother, and older sister, who had lived in the part of town called Fukuro. And besides, she felt drawn by some fascination, just as Father Kleinsorge had been. She discovered that her family were all dead. She went back to Kabe, so amazed and depressed by what she had seen and learned in the city, that she could not speak that evening. A comparative orderliness, at least, began to be established at the Red Cross Hospital. Dr. Sasaki, back from his rest, undertook to classify his patients, who were still scattered everywhere, even on the stairways. The staff gradually swept up the debris. Best of all, the nurses and attendants started to remove the corpses. Disposal of the dead by decent cremation and enshrinement is a greater moral responsibility to the Japanese than adequate care of the living. Relatives identified most of the first day's dead in and around the hospital. Beginning on the second day, whenever a patient appeared to be moribund, a piece of paper with his name on it was fastened to his clothing. The corpse detail carried the bodies to a clearing outside, placed them on pyres of wood from ruined houses, burned them, put some of the ashes in envelopes intended for exposed X-ray plates, marked the envelopes with the names of the deceased, and piled them, neatly and respectfully, in stacks in the main office. In a few days, the envelopes filled one whole side of the impromptu shrine. In Kabe, on the morning of August 15th, 10-year-old Toshio Nakamura heard an airplane overhead. He ran outdoor and identified it with a professional eye as a B-29. "There goes Mr. B!" he shouted. One of his relatives called out to him, "Haven't you had enough of Mr. B?" The question had a kind of symbolism. At almost that very moment, the dull, dispirited voice of Hirohito, the Emperor Tenno, was speaking for the first time in history over the radio. "After pondering deeply the general trends of the world and the actual conditions obtaining in our empire today, we have decided to effect a settlement of the present situation by resorting to an extraordinary measure." Mrs. Nakamura had gone to the city again to dig up some rice she had buried in her neighborhood association air raid shelter. She got it and started back for Kobe. On the electric car, quite by chance, she ran into her younger sister, who had not been in Hiroshima the day of the bombing. "Have you heard the news?" her sister asked. "What news?" "The war is over." "Don't say such a foolish thing, sister." "But I heard it over the radio myself." And then in a whisper, "It was the Emperor's voice." "Oh," Mrs. Nakamura said. She needed nothing more to make her give up thinking, in spite of the atomic bomb, that Japan still had a chance to win the war. In that case. Sometime later, in a letter to an American, Mr. Tanimoto described the events of that morning. "At the time of the post-war, the marvelous thing in our history happened. Our emperor broadcasted his own voice through radio directly to us common people of Japan. August 15th, we were told that some news of great importance could be heard, and all of us should hear it. So I went to Hiroshima Railway Station. There sat a loudspeaker in the ruins of the station. Many civilians, all of them were in bondage, some being helped by shoulder of their daughters, some sustaining their injured feet by sticks. They listened to the broadcast, and when they came to realize the fact that it was the emperor, they cried with full tears in their eyes. What a wonderful blessing it is that Tenno himself call on us and we can hear his own voice in person. We are thoroughly satisfied in such a great sacrifice." When they came to know the war was ended, that is, Japan was defeated, they, of course, were deeply disappointed, but followed after their emperor's commandment in calm spirit, making wholehearted sacrifice for the everlasting peace of the world, and Japan started her new way. Four, panic, grass, and fever few. On August 18th, 12 days after the bomb burst, Father Kleinsorge set out on foot for Hiroshima from the novitiate with his papier-mâché suitcase in his hand. He had begun to think that this bag, in which he kept his valuables, had a talismanic quality because of the way he had found it after the explosion, standing handle side up in the doorway of his room. While the desk under which he had previously hidden it was in splinters all over the floor. Now he was using it to carry the yen belonging to the Society of Jesus to the Hiroshima branch of the Yokohama Specie Bank, already reopened in its half-ruined building. On the whole, he felt quite well that morning. It is true that the minor cuts he had received had not healed in 3 or 4 days, as the rector of the novitiate, who had examined them, had positively promised they would. But Father Kleinsorge had rested well for a week and considered that he was again ready for hard work. By now he was accustomed to the terrible scene through which he walked on his way into the city, the large rice field near the novitiate, streaked with brown. The houses on the outskirts of the city, standing but decrepit, with broken windows and disheveled tiles, and then, quite suddenly, the beginning of the 4 square miles of reddish-brown scar, where nearly everything had been buffeted down and burned. Range on range of collapsed city blocks, with here and there a crude sign erected on a pile of ashes and tiles. "Sister, where are you?" Or, "All safe, and we live at Toyosaka." Naked trees and canted telephone poles. The few standing, gutted buildings only accentuating the horizontality of everything else. The Museum of Science and Industry, with its dome stripped to its steel frame, as if for an autopsy. The modern Chamber of Commerce building, its tower as cold, rigid, and unassailable after the blow as before. The huge, low-lying camouflage city hall. The row of dowdy banks, caricaturing a shaken economic system. And in the streets, a macabre traffic, hundreds of crumpled bicycles, shells of streetcars and automobiles, all halted in mid-motion. The whole way, Father Kleinsorge was oppressed by the thought that all the damage he saw had been done in one instant by one bomb. By the time he reached the center of town, the day had become very hot. He walked to the Yokohama Bank, which was doing business in a temporary wooden stall on the ground floor of its building, deposited the money, went by the mission compound just to have another look at the wreckage, and then started back to the novitiate. About halfway there, he began to have peculiar sensations. The more or less magical suitcase, now empty, suddenly seemed terribly heavy. His knees grew weak. He felt excruciatingly tired. With a considerable expenditure of spirit, he managed to reach the novitiate. He did not think his weakness was worth mentioning to the other Jesuits. But a couple of days later, while attempting to say Mass, he had an onset of faintness, and even after 3 attempts was unable to go through with the service. And the next morning, the rector, who had examined Father Kleinsorge's apparently negligible but unhealed cuts daily, asked in surprise, "What have you done to your wounds?" They had suddenly opened wider and were swollen and inflamed. As she dressed on the morning of August 20th in the home of her sister-in-law in Kabe, not far from Nagatsuka, Mrs. Nakamura, who had suffered no cuts or burns at all, though she had been rather nauseated all through the week, she and her children had spent as guests of Father Kleinsorge and the other Catholics at the novitiate, began fixing her hair and noticed, after one stroke, that her comb carried with it a whole handful of hair. The second time, the same thing happened, so she stopped combing at once. But in the next 3 or 4 days, her hair kept falling out of its own accord, until she was quite bald. She began living indoors, practically in hiding. On August 26th, both she and her younger daughter, Maiko, woke up feeling extremely weak and tired, and they stayed on their bedrolls. her son and other daughter, who had shared every experience with her during and after the bombing, felt fine. At about the same time, he lost track of the day, so hard was he working to set up a temporary place of worship in a private house he had rented in the outskirts. Mr. Tanimoto felt suddenly ill, with a general malaise, weariness, and feverishness, and he, too, took to his bedroll on the floor of the half-wrecked house of a friend in the suburb of Ushida. These four did not realize it, but they were coming down with the strange, capricious disease which came later to be known as radiation sickness. Miss Sasaki lay in steady pain in the Goddess of Mercy Primary School at Hatsukaichi, the fourth station to the southwest of Hiroshima on the electric train. An internal infection still prevented the proper setting of the compound fracture of her lower left leg. A young man who was in the same hospital and who seemed to have grown fond of her in spite of her unremitting preoccupation with her suffering, or else just pitied her because of it, lent her a Japanese translation of De Maupassant. And she tried to read the stories, but she could concentrate for only 4 or 5 minutes at a time. The hospitals and aid stations around Hiroshima were so crowded in the first weeks after the bombing, and their staffs were so variable, depending on their health and on the unpredictable arrival of outside help, that patients had to be constantly shifted from place to place. Miss Sasaki, who had already been moved 3 times, twice by ship, was taken at the end of August to an engineering school, also at Hatsukaichi. Because her leg did not improve but swelled more and more, the doctors at the school bound it with crude splints and took her by car on September 9th to the Red Cross Hospital in Hiroshima. This was the first chance she had had to look at the ruins of Hiroshima. The last time she had been carried through the city's streets, she had been hovering on the edge of unconsciousness. Even though the wreckage had been described to her, and though she was still in pain, the sight horrified and amazed her, and there was something she noticed about it that particularly gave her the creeps. Over everything, up through the wreckage of the city, in gutters, along the riverbanks, tangled among tiles and tin roofing, climbing on charred tree trunks, was a blanket of fresh, vivid, lush, optimistic green. The verdancy rose even from the foundations of ruined houses. Weeds already hid the ashes, and wildflowers were in bloom among the city's bones. The bomb had not only left the underground organs of the plants intact, it had stimulated them. Everywhere were bluets and Spanish bayonets, goosefoot, morning glories and daylilies, the hairy-fruited bean, purslane and clotburn, sesame and panic grass and feverfew, especially in a circle at the center. Sickle senna grew in extraordinary regeneration, not only standing among the charred remnants of the same plant, but pushing up in new places, among bricks and through cracks in the asphalt. It actually seemed as if a load of sickle senna seed had been dropped along with the bomb. At the Red Cross Hospital, Mrs. Sasaki was put under the care of Dr. Sasaki. Now, a month after the explosion, something like order had been reestablished in the hospital, which is to say that the patients who still lay in the corridors at least had mats to sleep on, and that the supply of medicines, which had given out in the first few days, had been replaced, though inadequately, by contributions from other cities. Dr. Sasaki, who had but 1 17-hour sleep at his home on the third night, had ever since then rested only about 6 hours a night on a mat at the hospital. He had lost 20 pounds from his very small body. He still wore the ill-fitting glasses he had borrowed from an injured nurse. Since Miss Sasaki was a woman and was so sick, and perhaps he afterward admitted, just a little bit because she was named Sasaki, Dr. Sasaki put her on a mat in a semi-private room, which at that time had only 8 people in it. He questioned her and put down on her record card, in the correct, scrumped-up German in which he wrote all his records, noting that she was a medium-sized female patient in good general health, that she had a compound fracture on the left tibia with swelling of the left lower leg, that her skin and visible mucous membranes were heavily spotted with petechiae, which are hemorrhages about the size of grains of rice or even as big as soybeans, and in addition, that her head, eyes, throat, lungs, and heart were apparently normal, and that she had a fever. He wanted to set her fracture and put her leg in a cast, but he had run out of plaster of Paris long since. So he just stretched her out on a mat and prescribed aspirin for her fever and glucose intravenously and diastase orally for her undernourishment, which she had not entered on her record because everyone suffered from it. She exhibited only one of the queer symptoms so many of his patients were just then beginning to show, the spot hemorrhages. Dr. Fujii was still pursued by bad luck, which still was connected with rivers. Now he was living in the summer house of Mr. Okuma in Fukawa. This house clung to the steep banks of the Ota River. Here his injuries seemed to make good progress, and he even began to treat refugees who came to him from the neighborhood, using medical supplies he had retrieved from a cache in the suburbs. He noticed in some of his patients a curious syndrome of symptoms that cropped out in the third and fourth weeks. But he was not able to do much more than swathe the cuts and burns. Early in September, it began to rain, steadily and heavily. The river rose. On September 17th, there came a cloudburst and then a typhoon, and the water crept higher and higher up the bank. Mr. Okuma and Dr. Fujii became alarmed and scrambled up the mountain to a peasant's house. Down in Hiroshima, the flood took up where the bomb had left off, swept away bridges that had survived the blast, washed out streets, undermined foundations of buildings that still stood. And 10 miles to the west, the Ono Army Hospital, where a team of experts from Kyoto Imperial University was studying the delayed affliction of the patients, suddenly slid down a beautiful pine-dark mountainside into the inland sea and drowned most of the investigators and their mysteriously diseased patients alike. After the storm, Dr. Fujii and Mr. Okuma went down to the river and found that the Okuma house had been washed altogether away. Because so many people were suddenly feeling sick nearly a month after the atomic bomb was dropped, an unpleasant rumor began to move around, and eventually it made its way to the house in Kabe where Mrs. Nakamura lay bald and ill. It was that the atomic bomb had deposited some sort of poison on Hiroshima, which would give off deadly emanations for 7 years. Nobody could go there all that time. This especially upset Mrs. Nakamura, who remembered that in a moment of confusion on the morning of the explosion, she had literally sunk her entire means of livelihood, her Sankoku sewing machine, in the small cement water tank in front of what was left of her house. Now, no one would be able to go and fish it out. Up to this time, Mrs. Nakamura and her relatives had been quite resigned and passive about the moral issue of the atomic bomb. But this rumor suddenly aroused them to more hatred and resentment of America than they had felt all through the war. Japanese physicists who knew a great deal about atomic fission, one of them owned a cyclotron, worried about lingering radiation at Hiroshima, and in mid-August, not many days after President Truman's disclosure of the type of bomb that had been dropped, they entered the city to make investigations. The first thing they did was roughly to determine a center by observing the side on which telephone poles all around the heart of the town were scorched. They settled on the Torii gateway of the Gokoku Shrine, right next to the parade ground of the Shogoku Regional Army Headquarters. From there, they worked north and south with Lauritsen electroscopes, which are sensitive to both beta rays and gamma rays. These indicated that the highest intensity of radioactivity near the Torii was 4.2 times the average natural leak of ultra-short waves for the Earth of that area. The scientists noticed that the flash of the bomb had discolored concrete to a light reddish tint, had scaled off the surface of granite, and had scorched certain other types of building material, and that consequently the bomb had, in some places, left prints of the shadows that had been cast by its light. The experts found, for instance, a permanent shadow thrown on the roof of the Chamber of Commerce building, 220 yards from the rough center, by the structure's rectangular tower. Several others in the lookout post on top of the Hypothek Bank, 2,050 yards away. Another in the tower of the Chukwu Electric Supply Building, 800 yards. Another projected by the handle of a gas pump, 2,630 yards. And several on granite tombstones in the Gokoku Shrine, 35 yards. By triangulating these and other such shadows with the objects that formed them, the scientists determined that the exact center was a spot 150 yards south of the Torii and a few yards southeast of the pile of ruins that had once been the Shima Hospital. A few vague human silhouettes were found, and these gave rise to stories that eventually included fancy and precise details. One story told how a painter on a ladder was monumentalized in a kind of bas relief on the stone facade of a bank building on which he was at work, in the act of dipping his brush into his paint can. Another, how a man in his cart on the bridge near the Museum of Science and Industry, almost under the center of the explosion, were cast down in an embossed shadow, which made it clear that the man was about to whip his horse. Starting east and west from the actual center, the scientists, in early September, made new measurements, and the highest radiation they found this time was 3.9 times the natural leak. Since radiation of at least 1,000 times the natural leak would be required to cause serious effects on the human body, the scientists announced that people could enter Hiroshima without any peril at all. As soon as this reassurance reached the household in which Mrs. Nakamura was concealing herself, or, at any rate, within a short time after her hair had started growing back, her whole family relaxed their extreme hatred of America, and Mrs. Nakamura sent her brother-in-law to look for the sewing machine. It was still submerged in the water tank, and when he brought it home, she saw, to her dismay, that it was all rusted and useless. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen to next week, the final part of Hiroshima by John Hersey. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New York readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.